You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Welcome to the Choose FI Radio podcast. Today on the show, we have brought on Nick Loper. This is a highly, highly requested episode from our community, and I think it's a very, very important one. And one of the common themes that I hear are that I've been impressed by the idea of a side hustle. I get that it's a valuable tool to reach financial independence, but I don't have any ideas. When anybody emails me and asks, like, how do I come up with an idea? I always say, go listen to Side Hustle Nation, because there are over 200 episodes that are jam-packed with ideas. You don't need to come up with something original. You just need to find something that lights you up and implement that in your own local area. That's incredibly inspiring. But I thought even more than that, today what we could do is have Nick come on the show and help us develop a framework so any individual listening to this can take their own inclinations, their own strengths, and take a look at their options and find something that serves them. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, that was a good intro for Nick. I'm just looking forward to chatting with him. I've had the good fortune of meeting him a couple of times at FinCon over the years, and just a really nice guy, really engaging, and just has a ton of information. At the time we're recording this, he's 229 episodes into the Side Hustle Nation podcast, and he's just seen it all. And I think growing your income is so crucial in this day and age, just in the FI mentality, in the FI world. We talk a lot about cutting expenses, but then having Alan Donegan on the show and really starting to focus on how can we grow our income has become a crucial aspect of where we're taking this. So with that, Nick, we are thrilled to have you here and welcome to the podcast.
You bet, guys. Thanks for having me. And I think, Brad, you nailed it. There's only so much that you can cut, but if you can increase your income, you have really almost unlimited upside. And so that's, at least for me, a more exciting thing to talk about than like, oh, I'm going to save money on toilet paper this month.
All right. Well, what I thought we could do, Nick, you have an incredible story on your own in terms of how you got out of a W-2 job and started pursuing a side hustle, which then became a main business. And that is its own episode. But I think for today, I don't think it's going to serve our audience quite as well. So I want to go ahead and set the stage and maybe just have you explain in your mind why side hustles are so important to consider.
Absolutely. It's about cutting your own paycheck and the confidence that comes with that, but also the, call it the financial empowerment from being able to do so. So even, I'll give the example of my wife. She's still an engineer by day, but she does wedding photography, family photography, nights and weekends. And it's been a sea change in her attitude towards like, oh, I am more than what it says on my business card. I'm more than what it says on my paycheck every 2 weeks. Because it's like, okay, all of a sudden I have value in the marketplace outside of just what my employer says. So I think it's really, really powerful from that financial empowerment standpoint and just to build skills and have some fun along the way.
You know, you have this tagline that I know I've seen you use in the past, and it basically says it's not what you do in your 9 to 5, it's what you do in your 5 to 9. Tell me a little bit more about that.
We think of our earning power as capped during our workday. And it's just not the case. In fact, my friend Julian Gordon put it this way. It's like, you're already an entrepreneur. Your boss is just your biggest employer. Your boss is just your biggest client. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting way to think about it. It's like, in my 5 to 9, I'm a free agent. I can go do what I want.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that, Nick. And I've heard you say before something to the effect of one source of income is risky. I think that's what stuck out to me the most of any of the podcasts that I've listened to with you. And you're saying here, your boss or your employer, that's your biggest client. But man, is it a risky scenario to make them your only client?
Yeah. Did you guys meet Vincent Puglisi at Podcast Movement?
Huge fans of Vincent. Absolutely.
Yeah. So Vincent told the story of, you know, he's a photographer as well, wedding photographer and corporate events and sports photography, all sorts of cool stuff. He gave the example of, you know, his coworkers, like, well, what happens if you if you get fired? What happens if this client doesn't come through? He's like, I'm going to be okay. I got 30 of them, you know, lined up for this summer. What happens if your client falls through or doesn't pay you? He's like, oh, okay, good point. It's just like kind of flipped it right on his old coworker's head.
Yeah, it's amazing how people really misunderstand that level of risk. It has always struck me as risky to be in the corporate world where if layoffs happen, and maybe in fairness, this goes way back to when I started my job at 22, I started working at Arthur Andersen, which at the time was the most reputable and biggest accounting firm in the entire world. It was like a dream job. 9 months later, that firm did not exist. That really seared that in my mind, that things can happen. Who knows if you get laid off tomorrow, right? And even if it's a dream job, even if you're making a great salary, who knows what can happen? So yeah, really spreading that level of risk is a crucial, crucial point. And I hope everyone's hearing that loud and clear.
Yeah, it's hard kind of riding what may be the tail end of a 10-year bull market and, you know, record low unemployment, where it's like, hey, you need to diversify your income. But I still think it rings true because the memories of the last recession are pretty deep, at least, you know, around us.
So side hustling is a form both of diversification and grabbing control back for you. Is that fair?
Yes.
Let's talk about building a framework. So we, like I said earlier, we have individuals that have started to get control, significant control over their financial ground game. And maybe due to some of the other principles that we talk about, they have finally for the first time in their life bandwidth. That's an incredible thing all by itself that's worth talking about. But now they're saying to themselves, I want to do more. I want to pursue something else. I want to maybe look into starting a side hustle. Help us develop a framework to give to these individuals that are just looking to get started with something.
Well, let's go through a handful of these. So the first one that I have is called the intersection method. And what this looks like is you have a piece of paper with three columns on it. Column one is your skills or, you know, what you can do or what you have done in the past. You can look at your resume if you're looking for inspiration on this, because, you know, any job you've ever had, by definition, that was a skill somebody thought was worth paying for. Column two is your interests or your hobbies outside of work. Like, what do you like to do? I think that's important for a side hustle because the last thing you need is a second job that you hate. And then column three is your network. Who do you know? And maybe equally important, who did they know? Like, who do you, you know, what's your network's network in a way? And we'll talk about ways you can substitute a network for certain marketplaces in a minute. But I'll give you the example in, you know, a personal example is I used this intersection method to start a freelance nonfiction book editing business. I said, I don't want to read your vampire romance, but if you have a nonfiction book and specifically, you know, in the business realm, that sounds interesting to me. That's what I like to read. Because under the skills column, I had like, well, I've written a couple books myself, so there's some credibility. I was a decent English student in school. I feel like I could proofread. And then under the interest, I was reading these business books, you know, in my spare time anyways. So that was part of it. And then in the network, because I had written a couple business books, was a part of some different author groups and was able to kind of get some referral business relatively early on in that business through some of those networks. But actually my first clients, and this is where the substitution comes in, is I got my first clients from Fiverr. I put a gig up on Fiverr and said, I'll proofread your business book for $5. Of course, in the fine print, it says, okay, that'll get you your first 500 words. And, you know, if you want more, which every book is longer than that, you know, so it added up to some pretty significant orders over time. And I actually read some really interesting stuff and some not so great stuff, but it was a cool side hustle experiment to play around with.
So Nick, I have some follow-ups on this. We're always looking at both the psychology and at the very specific actionable tips. So talk me through where you were in your life when you decided to do this proofreading business. So how did this idea arise, I guess, is what I'm curious on the psychological level. And then on the actionable tip side, how did Fiverr come up? Did you look at a bunch of different options for, hey, here's how I can use my network and this is maybe the best option? Talk me through how you eventually landed on Fiverr as the way to go to get that first client.
So I really like Fiverr as a marketplace. First of all, a marketplace of buyers. We talk a lot about buy buttons, marketplaces, like where can you put your offer up where people are going to see it, where people are ready to spend money. Amazon, Udemy, Fiverr, Upwork, you know, platform, Etsy, eBay, platforms where people are spending money, right? And it's a really, really low overhead place to test this and see if it's going to get any interest, any traction, right? I mean, it's free to put up a gig and see if anybody buys it. I'd been playing around as a Fiverr seller probably for about a year at that point. So this was maybe summer of 2014, where my original side hustle, which was a footwear comparison shopping site, completely unrelated affiliate marketing business, was kind of in its twilight stages. Meanwhile, the side hustle show was kind of ramping up. And so I was experimenting with other stuff, and that would give me content for the blog, give me content for the podcast to come back and talk about. So I met a Fiverr seller who kind of, you know, went through the works on, you know, here's how it works. Here's how the upsell process can be. Your low dollar offer has to be some intro offer. He probably would have never gone down the path of like actual labor for $5. It would have been, you know, a pre-written PDF file or an audio file or something like that, where you could just deliver it in 2 seconds. And then if you wanted his specific expertise and time involvement, you could buy that in the upsells. So I played around with a few different offers on there, but the one that probably made the most was the book editing one.
Yeah, that's really cool. So Fiverr is an intriguing platform for me. I've been using them for years, back when it seemed like most of the gigs were actually $5. And now they've pivoted a bit to basically making it, like you said, those introductory offers. And people can make some serious money on Fiverr, certainly, if not through the platform, then through the relationships and the connections. But what are the barriers to entry? So someone's listening to this, and they just heard you describe like, okay, I can test out a bunch of these different gigs. What makes a good Fiverr listing? Like, are there resources that you've found? Do you recollect how long you spent creating your page? Because I assume that's the thing. If somebody has an idea, they might have 20 ideas. Like, maybe you had a bunch of different listings. Do you recollect how long it took you to create those, and like any specific things that you did that maybe stood out?
Well, that's great. If you have 20 different ideas, that's fantastic, because I think, at least this used to be the case, is you're allowed 20 different gig listings on Fiverr. So you can test them all out there. You throw them all out there and see what happens. It really didn't take a ton of time to put this up. It's a platform with a lot of constraints, which breeds creativity in a way, because it's like it forces everybody to, like, for this price, I will do X, right? It's very productized. It's not like Upwork or Freelancer.com or some of these others where it's like you're bidding on different projects is very open-ended. It's like, no, here's my offer, take it or leave it. And you can, you know, of course, you know, ask for client reviews, and you can beef up your profile. And now you can have different pricing tiers and packages and say, okay, you know, small, medium, and large based on what you want to do. Another guest on the show was a professional copywriter, and she'd be kind of doing that, you know, on the side for several years using the same intersection method. She said, well, you know what, I have an interest in these Kickstarter campaigns. Like, what makes the ones take off that do? Like, how come this potato salad gets, you know, funded at $50,000 and this one doesn't? So she combined her copywriting skill with her interest in crowdfunding campaigns and built a really serious business on Fiverr doing that, saying, look, I'm your go-to person, you know, if you need your product description, your campaign description for Kickstarter.
Let's talk about failure for a second. I think a lot of people take a look at starting the side hustle and are just afraid that it fails. But I know one of the things that you've done is constantly pivot inside of a sector or completely change sectors. And I'm just curious to hear you talk a little bit about this fear of failure.
I've gotten more failures than successes. I was talking actually with my wife, Bryn, the other day. I feel like I've had like 5 good ideas in my life and a whole lot of bad ones, but just executing on the good ones. So I try and position each new project as an experiment. I mean, this is how the side hustle show started. It was like a $60 experiment from the living room. It's like, that's how much the mic cost. And then it was, you know, $15 to host the audio files, which I didn't even know that you needed. I was like, oh, iTunes will host your file. Like, I had no idea how it even worked. But it's like positioning it as an experiment lessens the sting of failure. And it kind of gives you permission to say, okay, I'm going to try this out for a couple months. If I like it, if I see some traction, if I see some results, like, okay, I'm going to keep going at it. But if I don't, or it's not fun to work on, like, okay, then it's time to dust off, see what I learned, and move on to the next thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it certainly does. And it reminds me of a Thomas Edison quote when they were talking about all the different times he tried to invent the light bulb and it didn't work. And his response was, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. And I just thought that was a brilliant, brilliant quote from one of the most prolific inventors of all time. It took him years and 10,000 plus quote failures, right? That other people would say, but he was learning every single time. So yeah, I mean, I believe me, I totally hear you.
I think every business is an evolution. And you, I mean, you'll talk to people who are 5 years deep into it, 10, 15 years deep into it. The business model that they're working on today is probably very different from the one they started. But what they found was the best opportunities became visible once they were in motion. It's like the conversations that you have, it's the ideas that pop up. You might be working on something completely different and that sparks some, you know, creative thought like, oh, what if I try this instead? And that's absolutely been the case for me and for a ton of my guests as well.
Yeah. And that reminds me, I guess, as you're describing this intersection method, right? So like my original website was richmondsavers.com. And I actually wound up taking, you talk about like bringing these random skills and like we call it the talent stack here, but it's very similar to what you're describing, which is you take these random skills and you look for opportunities. I was into travel rewards and I also had a background as an accountant. I wound up looking at my individual website visitors almost as potential clients, as opposed to just one of, for many big sites, it's just the law of large numbers, essentially, like to make money, right? You get millions of visitors and some of them click on some things and you make some money. I looked at this and said, okay, I can actually run these numbers as an accountant and as like a lifetime value of customer, in essence. I wound up working one-on-one with people to help them with their travel rewards plans.
Nice.
That's probably like an example of what you're talking about here, which is I had no website traffic or essentially none. I got, you know, a couple thousand visitors. That was never going to make me an income, but I was able to take that pivot and say, okay, what if I did X? And nobody else is doing this. Nobody else is getting on the phone with their website visitors to actually like work through a travel rewards plan, right? But I did that and it worked out reasonably well.
Yeah, that's super cool. Perfect example of kind of cross-referencing your interests and your skills to find a unique market.
That's great. So first, we've discussed the intersection method, taking a look at what you've done in the past, looking at your interests and hobbies, looking at your network and kind of finding the intersection of those. And I think that's incredibly valuable. I love that we've kind of laid out some examples of what that would look like practically. What is the second method?
The second method is what sucks. You know, I normally like to focus on the positive, so definitely don't go too deep down this rabbit hole. But you can spend a couple days as you go through your day thinking of all of the less than awesome things that you come across or that you have to do, but you don't really want to do. So this is one that I'm borrowing from Noah Kagan from AppSumo and OK Dork. So one example that came across my desk just this week was a physical product invention. It's this little metal thingy that attaches to the bottom of commercial bathroom doors. You hook your shoe on it so you can open up the door with your foot instead of touching the gross handle. Perfect example of like a what sucks business model. This guy was like, dude, I just washed my hands. Now I got to touch this gross handle. There's got to be a better way. And so that was just one, you know, product invention that came out of that. And it could be a service idea. It could be, you know, any number of different, you know, content businesses. Like you guys have said, well, what sucks? There's no Financial Independence Podcast. Like, I can solve that problem.
Let's say someone is talking about actually building a physical product. This is something that's always scared me a little bit, much in the way that real estate kind of scares me a little bit. So like, let's say this individual says, I want to solve a problem. So maybe they do something as simple as going onto Amazon, looking at all the products that are available, and then going to look at the 3 and 4 star reviews and like, you know what, this is decent, but it's not great. It could use some improvement. These are what people are saying. Maybe I'll try this or tweak this and I'll build this product. Where does an individual go with no background in building something to now educating themselves to build and sell some useful device?
Well, this is actually like one of the hottest side hustles going, like doing almost exactly as you described, like looking at the Amazon listings, seeing where there might be some opportunities in that market to improve upon what's already out there. The most common place to start is China. And the site is Alibaba.com, where you can probably find the manufacturer of who made that subpar item that's getting not so awesome reviews. You could say, hey, there's a lot of feedback that says the buckle breaks or, you know, whatever it is, or maybe we can make this out of a thicker fabric or slightly higher quality material. And they said, sure, yeah, we can do that. Could you send me a sample? 4 weeks later, you probably have a sample in hand and it's like, you can test it out yourself and say, yeah, that's fantastic. Let's give it a shot. Much higher overhead, right? Because you're going to have, you know, minimum order quantities when dealing with any sort of manufacturing at scale. But it definitely one of the hottest side hustles going is tapping into the Amazon marketplace.
I genuinely have no idea what sort of overhead we're talking about. If we're talking about a small gadget, do you have any concept of what sort of money is involved for an individual to start exploring this from scratch? Like, let's say you wanted to develop a new belt buckle for whatever. How much money would you feel like you needed to go into this process with to get something started?
I would say $500 at the very low end. And then, you know, more realistic, probably $1,000 to $3,000 for that first minimum order. And you can, there's a lot of tricks you can play and say like, well, let me ask my boss. You can pretend to be a bigger company that you have. Oh, I have to get a few samples to my regional distribution team, something like that, you know, so they'll work with you and figure out, you know, there's potential for bigger orders down the road. So we're not just going to blow this guy off. Now, the other option. So that's like kind of like the DIY manufacturing method. Well, not DIY, because you're kind of outsourcing it to this Chinese factory. And of course, there's manufacturing in the US and wherever you want to go to. But an interesting alternative to that is the product licensing model, where you say, can I find a company that's in this space or in a similar space already and pitch them the idea? They manufacture it, and I just collect a royalty check. It's straight up passive income from your idea, right? You license it. Maybe you go through a preliminary patent process and you're kind of off to the races. So I talked to Stephen Key, who wrote, what's his book? It's like One Simple Idea. It's like the Bible on product licensing. And then I talked to a couple proteges or students of his. One guy was, he'd made a beer pitcher that, you know, it would like, you know, no foam out of the tap. Like that was his pitch on the beer pitcher. I thought that was fascinating. Another guest of mine, he described it as like a version of Pictionary that was like a card game. He sold the idea to Mattel and collected like $300,000 or something over the course of 10 years. I was like, holy crap, you know, that's easier than, you know, having to deal with the factory in China and the shipping and the fulfillment and the taxes in all these different states and dealing with Amazon and potential competitors popping up. Like, let somebody else take that risk. I just want to sign the deal for the license.
And all this goes back to just pain points. What sucks? What could be improved just a little bit?
Yeah, that's a powerful way to figure out, well, if you have this problem, somebody else probably does too.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I approach life also, is I'm just looking for, as we're always talking about here, that 1% better, the aggregation of marginal gains. And yes, just looking for these little pain points in your life, not because you're looking for the negative, but the exact opposite. You're looking to make your life easier and better by just making that change once. So for many of these issues, somebody else has solved it, which is great. If somebody else already has it, you go watch their YouTube video or read their blog article and it's done. But if not, you're arguing you can create this business around what sucks or pain points, as we call it.
And I should point out too, there's a big myth that you have to come up with something like totally new and curve jumping and innovative when there's, and this comes from Noah as well. It's like, you know, how many sushi restaurants, in his case, it was like always tacos. How many taco restaurants are in your town? You know, there's probably more than one. They've probably been in business longer than a year. So you can probably guess that more than one of them is profitable. Like, you don't have to come up with this completely new idea. You just have to serve a different market. And so I thought that was really powerful as well. It's like, well, just because somebody has done it before shouldn't stop you from getting into it. Of course, you know, Facebook is a famous example. Hey, that wasn't the first social network. Google, of course, wasn't the first search engine. So don't be dissuaded because somebody else had the same idea first.
So Nick, I want to really dive into the licensing and these physical products. Maybe if you could even just give us the resource or like your podcast episode, we can link to it in the show notes, because I suspect the answer will be far too in-depth for this necessarily. But that granular action step, right? Like, someone in our audience is listening and they have some great idea for a physical product. So you said go to Alibaba, which is great. But as I understand it, there are thousands or tens, probably more than that, tens of thousands of different manufacturers on that site. How does someone know how to navigate it without, you're not flying to China necessarily to have your $500 thing created. How does someone even navigate that? Do you have resources or could you point us in any direction for that?
Yeah, we've done a handful of episodes on Amazon FBA, so we can definitely link those up in the show notes for you. And one of my guests had some very specific criteria. He's like, well, you want to look for people who are gold rated. You want to look for people who have a fast response time. And oftentimes, as far as just narrowing it down, you're using keyword searches and you'll find oftentimes it's the same product images that show up on Amazon as on Alibaba. Like, oh yeah, we make, you know, product XYZ. It's like, hey, shoot, of course you do. That's the same exact picture as it on Amazon. And it's like, well, it's selling for 20 on Amazon. It's selling for $1.99 if I buy them in bulk over here. I think there's some margin in that. So it's kind of exciting to see. And then just, you know, starting the negotiation or starting the conversation with these guys and seeing, hey, I'm thinking of this tweak. Is that something you guys could do?
To go ahead and make this very easy for you guys, I did go ahead and look up on Side Hustle Nation to find the specific episodes that you should check out, and go listen to episode 173 with Stephen Key. And this had to do with licensing products. And then also another one that will be very beneficial for you on Side Hustle Nation is episode 263 with Greg Mercer. If these ideas really appeal to you, I think that's probably worth some of your time to go check that out. All right, back to the show. All right, Nick, so we've talked about intersection method and we've talked about pain points. Let's go ahead and talk about the third method. What do you got for us?
The third method is called rip, pivot, and jam. It is an idea that I've borrowed from the boys at the Tropical MBA podcast, one of my all-time favorite shows. What this involves is kind of like thinking back to, your NBA Jam video game playing days. It's like after that inbound pass, I'm going to steal that ball from you. I'm going to pivot and I'm going to jam it. So I'm going to take somebody else's business idea, business model. I'm going to pivot it to a new market, a new audience, a new service offering, whatever it is. And then jam is just the hustle. I'm going to go to town. I'm going to do the work. I'm going to make sure that this thing happens. One example that comes to mind is a friend of mine, Alexandra Kennan, runs urban hiking tours in San Francisco. She was a newcomer to the city, loved to explore it on foot, and there's lots of cool urban trails and staircases and all sorts of cool stuff to see. So she saw in the marketplace bike tours, walking tours, bus tours, Segway tours. Her business was a pivot on those. So I'm going to rip those ideas. People are already paying for tours, right? They've validated the market for me. I'm going to pivot that to just a slightly different angle. We're going to do urban hiking tours. Like, you want to do something active on your vacation to the city? Let's try this. And then jam, she just went to work. She, hustled for TripAdvisor reviews. She pitched this as like team building events to certain startups and stuff in the city. When we spoke, she had done, I think, 1,000, she guided 1,000 different people on these hikes at $50 a piece. And so she built a serious side hustle doing something that she really loved.
Nice. I'm very interested in this idea of outliers, like outsized returns. And in particular, I'm wondering, is there like a threshold at which, and I don't want to sound discriminatory, but there are some people will do anything for a dollar. Are there side hustles that you have kind of vetted? And after looking at them closely, you're like, honestly, while yes, it is a side hustle and yes, it will make some money, these are ones that I have kind of written off as ones that I wouldn't tell my friend that's interested in side hustles to pursue.
Well, you see a lot of kind of in the low hanging fruit in the make money online space, you see a lot of people plugging different, survey offers or Mechanical Turk and stuff like that. It's like, if you're dedicated to it, you can absolutely make money. It's not going to be an amazing hourly rate because it's something that anybody can do. It's like, you have to find something where there's a unique flavor to it that gives you some sort of pricing advantage. You could even say like Uber and Lyft are similar to that, where there's a constant downward pressure on your rates outside of different surge pricing and stuff, because almost everybody knows how to drive and almost everybody has a car. So there's a ceiling to how much you can earn. Now, I will say with Uber and Lyft, there is a cool hack that both of the apps have built in, and it's called destination mode. If you're making your morning commute, I'm going in this direction, I want to pick only up passengers who are going the same way. Somebody who's on my way, I think that's a cool way to kind of offset potentially your evening and morning commutes just by making a drive you're going to drive anyway. So you might find you really love driving. So then you kind of go on to the next thing. But that's kind of a lower tier side hustle, like tapping into the sharing economy, the Ubers, the Lyfts of the world, the Airbnbs of the world, even to a certain extent. We've seen people, I don't have a spare bedroom. I don't have like the money to invest in real estate. We've heard of people doing just subleasing, like doing the market research, figuring out what types of properties have the best returns, like they command the highest rates on Airbnb, they're most in demand, and approaching property owners and saying, I would like to sublease this property for you. Maybe they have it listed as a traditional 12-month lease, and say, hey, being upfront about it, saying like, this is what I intend to do. I'll even give you a premium on my monthly rate and I'll manage all the maintenance. I'll do all the stuff and go into town with a sublease. We actually just looked at a property here in Livermore where the guy had converted his garage into a studio apartment and he was making $1,000 a month on this. He's like, yeah, I'll park on the street for $1,000 a month. So there's some interesting ways to go about it there too.
That's really awesome. Nick, have you heard of, I think it's Turo. Have you heard of anybody doing something similar to that with their cars?
Yeah. So Turo is Airbnb, but for cars, like a rental car service or peer-to-peer rental car service. The best example that I have was I met a guy in, I think, Tampa, and he started out just with his wife's car. He's like, I travel for work. You know, she doesn't need two cars while I'm gone. Started out renting out his wife's car, was like, oh, there's something to this. And then, so he actually took out the lease on two new SUVs, and, you know, which was a little bit scary because that, you know, upped his monthly overhead by, I think, $500 a month for these two new cars to lease them. But he was bringing in $1,500 a month renting them out on Turo. And so he found similar by doing the market research that larger SUVs were like popular with families coming into town. So that's what he, you know, decided to build his own little rental fleet.
Yeah, that is really fascinating to me. I would love to see, like, I'm not sure if you can buy older cars. I assume you can put them on there. There might be some age, like it can't go back to 1985 automobile. But I wonder if there's some sweet spot additionally for that research of, okay, I don't necessarily need a new SUV. I can buy a one from 2013 or some such and make even more money.
Yeah, that might be worth exploring, and maybe even better when it's a car you acquire specifically for that purpose, because you don't have the emotional attachment to it. Like, I'm going to let strangers in my car. It's kind of weird.
Right. I mean, it's looking at it truly as a business. We talk about rental real estate a lot here on the podcast, and I see some similarities here in that people get so invested in their own single family home, what they live in. But if you look at rental real estate truly as a business, then you just run the numbers independent. Does this make sense? Is there net income at the end of the month? And you could do that similarly with Turo as you're describing it.
I've got a great one on the alternative real estate investments. So a guest on the podcast, he told me about, he wanted to get started in real estate, but is like, I don't have that kind of capital. Goes to his kid's friend's birthday party, and they've got one of these inflatable bounce houses there. And he's like, somebody is renting that right now. That's a form of real estate. So he goes home, finds one of these things used on Craigslist for like $800 and starts renting it out for $130, $140 a day. He was like, that pencils out way better than the 1% rule for traditional rental real estate. So I was really excited by his story too.
You know, it's amazing that it can be a very, very simple idea and there's just an opportunity there. It's not even an original idea. It's just something that you've seen work somewhere else and you say, oh, there is an opportunity here. And, you know, it strikes me that depending on the amount of time investment involved, $500 to $1,000 a month where there was nothing can be transformative for an individual. It resonated with me when you were talking about surveys, you know, kind of not making it past the barrier of usefulness. Like I can't, if I have to sit there in front of my computer screen clicking through stuff for 8 hours a day to make $50 a month, I'm going to shoot myself long before Grey's Anatomy comes on. But
yeah, there's an opportunity cost. Like how could you be better spending that time building something that maybe you actually enjoy a little bit more, that serves more people, that is more impactful, you know, for any host of reasons. Like nothing against, you know, the swag bucks or the inbox dollars of the world, because I definitely feature those on the site. Like I'll present those as an option for you, but just know this is not going to be, you know, a lifestyle changer in terms of, you know, the income that it's going to bring in.
Let's talk about a few more outliers on the other side. So things that someone presented you, people come to you with ideas at this point because you are the side hustle guy. I mean, you just have this incredible portfolio of stories that you've documented. So the amazing thing at this point is you've created this repository. So people are bringing their ideas to you. Let's talk about outliers the other way, where someone showed you the numbers of their business and you were just blown away.
One of the most surprising ones for me, and again, this is something that like anybody could potentially get into, you know, with whatever investment you're comfortable with, was the flea market flipper. Another guy from Florida who makes his full-time living, six-figure income, supports his family of five, you know, just buying and selling random stuff at the flea market. And I was just blown away by some of his trades. You know, he talked about finding a prosthetic leg. More recently, he told me about finding like a parking lot lifter, basically an air-conditioned box on stilts, like where people, you know, park it at theme parks and stuff. And he's like, they retail for $80,000. So if I could pick it up for six, I was confident there was going to be some margin in it. And he turned around and sold it the next month for $25,000. I was like, dude, that's a nice return on investment. That's like a way faster way to multiply money than some of the stuff that we hear about in the stock market investing or even real estate investing. He was a really inspiring dude, but he's obviously put in the work, sources inventory consistently, and knows how to sell it, and has done really, really well with it. But, you know, he told me about a challenge within his community of, you know, starting with something for free. And maybe this is a challenge for the Choose FI audience too. Starting with something for free, with something for $5 and seeing over the course of a year, what could you flip that into? Like, how could you parlay that into the bigger and better thing? So I don't know if you guys remember like the red paperclip guy from, you know, probably 10 or 15 years ago, but like traded his way up from a red paperclip, you know, basically playing, you know, bigger and better. You traded it for a pen, traded it for a thing, and you eventually worked his way up to a house over the course of a year.
I was actually Googling. I thought it was a penny to a house. And I was like typing into Google, what is that story? Before you even started with it. But I was like, flipping, that's amazing.
I'm inspired by stuff like that. Cause it's like, okay, you could start with something ridiculously small and, you know, just keep parlaying that into the next trade. And, you know, whether that's physical products, whether that's, you know, flea market flipping, or, you know, different business ideas. I mean, that's essentially what I've been doing over the last 15 years is, you know, taking what I've learned and then flipping it into the next idea, the next thing.
That last one, the flea market flipper, or I've seen people do this on FBA with Amazon Fulfillment by Amazon, where it's basically arbitrage. They're just finding products that are, for whatever reason, at a discount, whether it's at a flea market or in a big box retailer on the discount aisle, and they're finding a way to sell it for higher. How does someone get into that? I know my wife, who's a pretty shrewd shopper, like she tried to get into this. And I think I actually emailed with you about this a couple of years back. And she just got kind of stymied. She never moved forward. I'm curious if you have any like specific tips or if that even worked for you. I think you said that was one of your many experiments, right?
Yeah. So specifically on the Amazon FBA front, I heard about this on another podcast. And it didn't make sense because it was like, how have the Walmart employees not heard of this? Or how, with all of their data processing, like they have to know that that item is selling for more on Amazon and it has a low sales rank. So people, you know, it's turning. It just didn't make sense until I went out and did it. And you can do it for free. You can set up a free Amazon seller account, download the free Amazon seller app, and you could scan barcodes in the stores. It's like very much a needle in the haystack type of thing. Like I haven't done it since our son has been born. I find myself with less time to go trolling the aisles of Walmart and Home Depot. But I found profit in those aisles. And I was surprised by that. So I was just kind of like, okay, it's out there if you're willing to put in the work and do it. And we've seen, of course, people scale that to, you know, many, many thousands of dollars a month, even to the point of hiring other people to go do that shopping for them and going into wholesale and going into private label. But it's that age old business model of buy low and sell high. It's just kind of a new way to source your inventory and a new way to turn it over.
Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, follow rule number one. You know, Nick, I want to kind of make a slight pivot on this, and I want to talk about passive income. And let me tie this, I guess, back to 4-Hour Work Week, which was kind of an inspiration for both Brad and myself at varying levels. And I can tell you that what we have found, although Choose FI is, I'm passionate about it. I love it. I wouldn't walk away from it for anything. It's by no means passive. It is a full-time job, and that's fine. I'm totally good with it. I suspect that Side Hustle Nation is very similar. It requires you. And it's a full-time gig, maybe more than a full-time gig. But what I'm curious about is let's go back to this idea of passive income that kind of has been marketed to us and maybe to the community as this thing to aspire to. Do you have any examples from your kind of portfolio of ideas where people have truly landed on a passive income side hustle?
Man, passive income, that's the dream, right? So if you think about it, income is going to be generated from an asset that you buy, like a dividend stock, like that's probably the most passive income thing that I've discovered so far, or an asset that you built that could be, you know, a blog article that has affiliate links that ranks in Google, right? That's relatively passive. It could be a book that people discover on Amazon, like an asset that you created that serves you, or a product that you created that serves you. On the actual business side, there are a couple people who've gotten pretty close to passive, and it's been actually kind of inspiring. One recent example is Chris Schwab, who runs thinkmades.com. It's a residential cleaning service in the Washington, D.C. area. And I don't know, maybe he's branching out to Richmond at some point too. He started this as in his final semester at university. Like he was just full-time student. Like, I'm going to start this thing on the side. Never cleaned a house, lifted a mop himself, hired people to do that, found people who were excellent cleaners to do that. What he found was similar, like looking at those, not the 2 or 3 star reviews on Amazon, but looking at the 2-3 star reviews on Yelp and saying, nobody was complaining about the cleaning itself. They were complaining, oh, this business didn't return my calls. I can't reach anybody after 5 p.m. Like all this business stuff that should be easy. And he's like, I can figure out the cleaning stuff. Like, that's not rocket science. I'll just do the business stuff really well. And so he went to town marketing that, and in less than 2 years had built it to a point where he was doing 60 grand a year or 60 grand a month in business. He was had hired people to answer the phones, had hired cleaners, had hired virtual assistants to kind of like do all of the day-to-day customer support marketing stuff. And he was off, you know, onto the next thing. Like when I talked to him, he was running this thing 5-10 minutes a day from London, like all the way across the world. He's been, you know, traveling in Tokyo and stuff. So he had built systems that earned him passive income, and he's just taking a margin on doing that. And so I think that's an opportunity to steal his model is an opportunity in really any fragmented service industry that you see where there's no dominant regional or national player or brand. In the online space, one that comes to mind is Russ Perry from designpickle.com. He told me, look, I sucked at design, which is not what I expected to hear from the founder of a multi-million dollar design agency. He's like, but I can play matchmaker, which is essentially what Chris was doing. I can play matchmaker between people who need cleaning and the cleaners. In Russ's case, I can play matchmaker between the designers that I'm going to source largely from the Philippines and the customers. So he just played marketing, and he's got this huge team and was able to remove himself from the day-to-day work, which is a step that a lot of freelancers skip because the book editing thing, I got into this because that was my craft. Like that's what I did. Both of those guys skipped that step and saw just a separate opportunity where they could kind of play at a higher level.
Nick, that is absolutely brilliant. And that actually reminds me of, it's similar to point one and two of what you're saying here is the intersection method and what sucks, right? Finding these pain points where, while it's not the perfect case study in intersection of skills you've done in the past, but it's looking at positive attributes you have. Like what skills do you have? And it might be running a business. It might not be cleaning houses or renovating a kitchen. But if you found a pain point, which might be, hey, that contractor doesn't call me back, or hey, that maid company doesn't call me back because they're out cleaning all the time. But you can take your skills and actually build a business that will get rid of that pain point for everybody else that calls your company, in essence. I've seen this, and this is probably $100 million business. If someone does that with contractors, what is the age-old problem when you call a contractor? They don't call you back, or they don't show up on time for an estimate. And obviously, this is painting a broad brush, and it's slightly unfair, but like I've heard that in every city I've ever lived in. And it's because those folks are out there doing their jobs. They're not running a business, right? So if you can take your business skills and create that framework, then that can be passive income and it can solve a problem. So I just love how I'm seeing, at least, I'm looking at your framework of these three different methods and seeing two of them just in this very simple example.
All right. Well, before we let you go today, we want to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
Okay, deep breath.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Nick, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
The one that I've probably gotten the most value from over the years, business-wise, is Smart Passive Income with Pat Flynn. Now, on the FI front, I want to give a shout to Go Curry Cracker, Jeremy's site. He just has a really like unconventional take on a lot of different topics where everyone else is like, hey, you need to have your 529 plan set up for your kids or they're never going to get into school. He'll take the counterpoint. Betterment sucks. We're never going to buy a house. We're renters for life. He's got a little bit of a, you know, I'm so smart attitude, but he's got maybe the portfolio to back it up. So maybe it's earned. So I really sort of like his site, like just for always, you know, oh, I didn't think of it that way. So I recommend those two.
Question number two, do you have a favorite article of all time? Now, this can be one that you wrote or somebody else's.
Well, yeah, I won't plug my own stuff. This is actually, you won't find this anywhere on the site, but this is an article that had a big impact on me because it was published on a company internal blog, like internet type of thing. And it was called College Works Painting Ruined My Life. So College Works Painting was this house painting internship that I had during college. And at the end of the year, they published this post on their internal blog. And it goes on to explain, like, look, if you've made it this far, you've had your first taste of working for profits and not wages. You've seen, you know, probably some really cool successes, and you probably had the taste of some really painful setbacks and failures, but you're not going to be able to go back working a regular job. We've ruined your life, basically. It was the point of this article. Like, now that you had a taste, it's going to be really hard to step back from this entrepreneurship thing. And it was absolutely true, and one that's stuck with me for a lot of years.
Wow, that's neat. It's like taking the red pill, right, in the Matrix. You can't unsee it once you've seen it.
Yeah.
All right, Nick, question number three, your favorite life hack.
Man, I don't know if this qualifies as a life hack, but one thing that's made a big impact in, you know, my personal productivity and happiness is just to do one proactive thing before email, before social media, before diving into anybody else's agenda. And normally what that looks like is itemizing out my top three, at least, priorities for the next day, the night before, and making sure I do at least one of those before anything else.
And do you stick with it? So is that something that theoretically you would like to do? Or if you look back at the last week or two, you can say, yes, this is working for me.
Yeah, I'm pretty consistent with that. I found it's really important to, because even if you just do the one, like no matter, you know, whatever fires come up in the middle of the day, you know, you at least feel like you're making progress and you did that one proactive thing. So that's actually been a really important habit of mine.
It's interesting. It actually reminds me of an episode that we recorded with Dominic Cortuccio talking about drift state. And one of the ways to combat drift state is to be intentional about planning your day. And most of us just, the days meld into each other. The end of one day blurs into the beginning of the next. And usually Netflix is the transition. But just by carving out that small amount of time that you're discussing basically allows us to set the frame, which is an intentional life. And so I'm very much aware that you are a side hustler, maybe the foremost side hustler in our network, but you're also living this very, very intentional, optimized lifestyle. So that's really, really cool to share that. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
Biggest financial mistake. This is an easy one, and it's a two-parter because we got hosed on both ends of this deal. In 2007, we bought a townhouse in California for almost $500,000. Within 18 months, it was worth $200,000, 40% of what we paid. We were deeply, deeply underwater. It was a heavy burden on my wife and I, just every day, you know, waking up with the regret of that mistake. And in the meantime, you know, seeing our friends essentially move in next door for half price and them complaining about, oh, the market is so hard right now. It's, you know, you get in a bidding war. It's like, I don't want to hear it.
We need to find something else to talk about right now.
Yeah, it was just actually a really stressful time. And so we finally, years after we should have, we finally got up the nerve to say, okay, let's get out. The short sale debt forgiveness income tax thing supposedly is expiring. Let's get out of here. And so we eventually sold it. And then, of course, since then, the market has been red, red hot. And now we have to listen to all our friends talk about how much equity they have in their place. So it's just, we made a bad choice to buy it, and then we made a bad choice to sell it. So I'm kind of burned off of real estate for a little bit. So we are happy renters right now, and we'll ride that out for a little bit.
Brad, the key here is to hold on to this garbage property that you have in North Carolina forever.
Yeah, I don't think so. But yeah, Nick, I totally feel your pain, man. It's incredible to see something that you purchased. My case is slightly different. Mine was, unfortunately, it wound up being speculation, and I learned a great lesson from it. But man, to see it go down, like you said, 60% for me, it was even more than that. So it's been pretty brutal. But just like anything, you try to learn and move on, right? So
yeah, older and wiser now.
Yeah. How long have you been renting for?
For 5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, very cool.
All right, question number five, advice you would give your younger self.
Look, dude, you're not that smart. Maybe there's a corollary. Like, I wish I was half as smart now as I was when I was 16. I don't know. I probably was arrogant and cocky in a lot of ways. But the corollary to that is everything is learnable. Like, you can figure it out. You know, Brian Harris from Video Fruit has an awesome, awesome YouTube video. It's like, your only job as an entrepreneur is to figure it out. You learn how to do something, and then you get into the next hurdle in the road, and then, well, what do you do? Well, you figure it out, and you just keep doing that, lather, rinse, repeat. The other thing that would have been helpful to learn earlier on, or would have been helpful to be exposed to earlier on, was all of your stuff, all of the 4% rule stuff, like the financial independence stuff. I was lucky enough to have one of my high school math teachers, you know, took it upon himself to teach us about the market and dollar cost averaging and all this stuff. But where he stopped short was, what's the why? What's the end game? What are you saving for? I think that would have been a really powerful lesson to have, you know, at 16, 17, to say, oh, you know, if you can keep your expenses low, if you can save 25 times your income or your expenses, like, I think that would have made some different decisions. Probably wouldn't have bought that townhouse. You know, a lot of different things probably would have happened over the next 10 years had he gone, taken it to its logical conclusion.
Right, right. Because the math isn't enough for a 16 or 17 year old. Like, we fall asleep. Like, you got to find the red pill, and you have to build a why around it. That is eminently clear to me as well. All right. Now, I do have a bonus question for you. So we spend a lot of time talking about things that you don't purchase, but all of us make purchases, you know, at some point based on value. And so what we want to know is, let us know, what purchase have you made over the past 12 months that has added the most value to your life?
Oh, the 12 months is a kicker. I was going to go podcast mic, because obviously that's been a huge, you know, a life-changing purchase. But last 12 months, I'm going to have to go with the new e-bike that I got. Oh. I am absolutely in love with this thing. Every time I'm plowing into like a 17 mile an hour headwind effortlessly, I'm like, this was the best purchase ever. I've been like hemming and hawing over it for a couple years, and finally pulled the trigger last month or a couple months ago, and take the kid to school on the bike, you know, bike downtown to the coffee shop or to yoga. It's been, you know, really, really cool to have some battery power behind me.
That's neat. So have you gotten rid of your car mostly? Like, are you riding the e-bike around the vast majority of the time? Or how have you seen it impact your driving preferences?
Yeah, I try to use the bike to replace car miles where I can. So I'm taking, you know, I'm a month into it, taking 100, 130 miles that I would have driven off the road. So I'll probably have maybe a 3-year break-even window just on the, you know, on the price of gas and how many miles that my car gets. So that's not horrible. And it's just the pure joy of like not having to sweat up our giant hill or, you know, just plow every direction I ride in this town seems like it's into a stiff headwind. So just, I'm loving life every time I'm on that thing.
The whole city has opened up to you.
Yes, it's awesome. Highly recommended.
All right, Nick, this episode's been phenomenal. And I think we've actually been able to hit on some points that I haven't heard on other podcasts, which is really was a goal of mine, because you do have just this wealth of information that you've collected over time. What is the best way for someone listening to this that is just over the moon at all these different ideas and wants to find out more? What's the best way for someone to connect with you and with your content?
Of course, would love to have you tune into the Side Hustle Show. You can pick and choose, like kind of like choose your own adventure, some of the episodes that we talked about or the different ones that sound interesting to you. If you're still on the fence looking for an idea, you'll find a lot of the ideas that we talked about and a whole host of other ones at sidehustlenation.com/ideas. It's a page that I constantly keep updated with, you know, just different ideas that I come across or that different guests have done. No opt-in required over there. So definitely encourage you to check it out.
Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You bet, guys. Thanks for having me.
This is something that I know that many of you have asked about, and I think it is absolutely builds on the wonderful topics that Alan Donegan covered with us in episode 30. Hopefully this came off as more of just planting seeds. Like, you don't need to have a $1 million idea. I hope you do. I really do. But it doesn't require that. And I think there's something to be said for just thinking about side hustles in a very general sense and then taking action on one. It changes your entire world.
Yeah. And I love the concept of just looking for pain points in your life and just taking your skills and trying to figure out a business that may work and just experimenting. That's what's so cool about this. It really is so easy to create a business in this day and age and doesn't cost that much money. So why not experiment? Why not just let your mind run free with potential businesses and see what you can actually take action on? Right? That's what we're all about here at Chooseify, is doing something, getting up off the couch and taking action. So I hope this inspired you. And yeah, I just can't wait to hear side hustles that actually come to fruition thanks to this episode.
All right, my friends, if you got value from this episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at Chooseify, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to chooseify.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to chooseify.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI, and right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.